Hit it. What's going on?
I'm making sure I have enough storage on my Mac because I haven't bought an external hard drive yet.
You need to get a higher paying job so that you can afford something like that.
I should talk to my boss, see if he can buy me one.
We could expense that. Oh. Welcome, my friends, to another episode of Man vs. World. I am your host, Mark Kwepit, and I am joined, as always, by Pete. What's going on, Pete?
Oh, not too much. Just got some great stuff I'm looking forward to diving into here. Should we just rock and roll?
Let me see. Do we have anything interesting to talk about? No, I'm just doing, like, boring shit right now, like financials and taxes and that kind of stuff.
Taxes?
It's honestly the worst.
It's not April.
Yeah, well, I mean, not time. Well, I mean, well, technically we're supposed to be paying quarterly taxes, but really it's more about like all this bookkeeping crap. Like, the world would be so much simpler if you didn't have to keep track of all of your money. If you could just kind of just let all that stuff just build up in the closet and then have it be fine. I don't know. Do you know? Some people like it. I've actually met people who enjoy doing taxes. It makes them feel like clean and organized and stuff like that. But I guess there's like people who like enjoy doing dishes and vacuuming and stuff like that too. So I don't know. It's definitely not for me.
The word you're looking for is nerds.
Nerds. Yeah. Yeah.
No, I'm envious of them though, because, I really don't like that stuff. So I wish I did, because then I wouldn't have to pay somebody else to do that stuff. I wouldn't have to pay, you know. But I just...
I know.
What I do... You know, no, I'm not going to give that advice here today. It'll probably get me in trouble. Anyway. I was watching a video this week I wanted to tell you about, because there's this drummer that I've been following for a long time on YouTube. His name is Harry Meary. I think that's how you say his name. And this guy has a video showing the behind the scenes of what it's like to be a studio musician in Nashville. And he goes to the studio and they have these things called 5 and 3s. And I'd never heard of a 5 and 3 before, but apparently what they do is they record 5 songs in 3 hours. And what those songs are is a songwriter says, hey, I want a demo done for my song. So they hire all these musicians, they record them in their 5 and 3s, and then the demos get passed around behind the scenes like baseball cards. And it's really interesting because what happens is eventually a major label artist might say, oh, I want to record that. And then they cut it and they do a deal and that's that. But most of these songs that get traded around, they never are anything at all. And so there's this whole ocean of demos and songs that people have written and recorded that no one will ever hear besides the people behind the scenes. And I found that really interesting because, you know, you tweeted out this week the importance of quantity when it comes to producing creative work. And so I thought it'd be interesting to talk about, is there any art form where you're not served by increasing the output?
Anyone where you're not served by it? I can't think of anything off the top of my head. I mean, like, there's so much that goes in the other way that you're just actually better served by getting more out more quickly. I guess maybe the one thing that you could argue against with something like that would be something that requires like super intense like world building, where like you need to, like, you've been like building up like a fantasy world for like years and years and years, and to try and like continuously redo that would be counterproductive. So I can see maybe something like that, where there's a huge investment in just getting the ball rolling, and to start that over again would be counterproductive. But I think for most things, you know, really it's all about speed and momentum. I mean, that's the big reason why I created my momentum method course, because I saw, like, all right, the key to pretty much everything in the modern world is just getting more quality reps in. And if you get the reps in, then you're going to get incredible results. And the big obstacle most guys run into is that they just feel like they have to hold back and they need to polish up everything until it's perfect before they bring it to the world. You know, if you're a content creator, a writer, you know, even if it's just like something like you're trying to put together a business plan for a side hustle or something like that, just go ahead and figure out like the smallest kernel that you can ship and just ship it. Just do it. Do it quick. Don't try and get it 100% right. Okay. Do it 80% right. What is it? What's his name? Dan Sullivan's got a quote. It's like 80 is better than 100 because the 80 actually gets results, gets things moving, gets things going, but 100 pretty much like never gets done.
Right.
You know, you're never going to get something 100% of the way there. And this isn't like an excuse to put out low quality work. All right. It's just that if you follow this path of rapid iteration of putting in kind of like the 80-20 effort, you can actually reach something of incredibly high quality far more quickly than if you were trying to get to that 100% right off the bat. And in some cases, people actually, they get too good at their craft in a way that they need to go back to something a little bit messier and more raw to make it cool again. Like there's a band I used to really love. I still like them, but I was obsessed with them when I was younger, and they're called NoFX. They're like one of the, you know, the most popular punk bands who was never really popular. And they, you know, they've been making music since the 80s, have like a ton of albums and stuff. And there got to be a point where they were like too good at playing their instruments. Yeah. And they, you know, they lost kind of that raw, kind of unpolished punk sound that they had. And so what they did is they have a couple of albums where they literally, like he teaches the songs and they record them all within like 24 hours or something like that, where they would purposely like do them super, super rough, just so they could capture that sort of raw feel again. And there's something like magical to that where, you know, yeah, there's a lot of value in putting out that high quality, polished final product. But I think that if you want to get people to really trust you, to really buy into you, there's something endearing about, you know, typos. There's something endearing about those rough edges to things because people can see the human in it. And I think in this world where we're going to be increasingly inundated by AI, people are going to be more and more hyper aware of those little subtle cues that let them know that this is something put forth by a real person. Because ultimately, people want a human connection, I think, when they consume something, when they purchase something. They want to know that there's like a real person on the other side, and that person like really like cares about what they are doing. And the ultra polished, like, you know, high production value thing can be great. You know, there's absolutely a place for it, but there's so much posturing that has to like get done, in my opinion, to like really sell that, at least to me. Like if I see an ad from a company on, like, let's say on social media or something like that, and it's super polished, super high production value, but they've got like barely any followers, to me, that doesn't hit as hard as the person who's just like shooting a raw, like authentic message right into their camera, who's clearly like, they're just hustling. They're just practicing the momentum method. They're getting something out there. They've got an offer. They're here trying to make something happen. And, you know, you can go with it or not, but I like that. And what we're going to be seeing kind of as a contrasting signal is like the thing, the telltale signs of like, oh, is this written by AI? Is this like, you know, some bullshit here? Because frankly, as soon as I start seeing that stuff, I'm uninterested. Like as soon as I see something that I'm like pretty confident was written in ChatGPT, I don't want any part of it anymore. Yeah. Because that's that's like someone who's willing to use that kind of stuff and not go through the work of making it their own is not someone that I want to buy from, because at least at this point, because that kind of stuff to me is mostly being utilized by people who are just looking to cash in on a quick, you know, buck, and haven't really invested in their process super a ton. And, you know, there's varying levels of accuracy probably to that heuristic, but for me personally, that's where I stand on it.
Have you heard of the band 1st of October?
No.
They take this NoFX idea to the next level, because what these guys do is the band only exists one day a year. It's on October 1st, of course. And so what they do is they meet at a studio and they write and record an entire album in one day and they film the videos and stuff. Wow. It's so cool. I love it. That's a really fun one if you guys want to check that out. But there's also something to be said about taking high quality and putting it in a place where you don't see high quality. I think Casey Neistat is a great example of this, right? He took the medium of vlogging and he just said, I'm now Casey Neistat's stuff prior to that might have been higher quality in some people's estimates. I don't know if he would consider that to be the case, because you have more than 24 hours to make the video, right? So he has more time at his disposal, but within that restriction of I only have 24 hours to make this thing, he said, I'm going to raise the bar within this tiny little constraint here, and I'm going to make something that's better quality than everybody else who's doing the same thing, but it's still lower quality than what I do. I find that really interesting. Yeah. I think that's a great way to stand out.
That's a good point. Yeah. I mean, like, at the end of the day, though, what he has there is a tight shipping window. You know, he's not spending a week on polishing up his vlog.
Correct.
Right? He's still, and for those of you who don't know Casey Neistat, he basically is just like this vlogger who has, you know, really good film editing skills, and he makes it look super cool. It looks like very high production value. But the thing is that he still has this time constraint. And what I found is that, and I'm not the only person who's found this, people have been saying this for a long time, is that constraint is really the key to innovation. It's like, until you accept your constraints, you're not really forced to make any creative choices. Because you think about it, if you have unlimited time, unlimited resources, unlimited options, then you don't need to create anything. You can literally just do it all and do it all perfectly. I guess at some point you need to decide what direction you want to go with. But the more constraint you put on it, the more you're forced to extract from the medium. So, for example, if you confine your painting or your piece of art to, you know, an 8.5 by 11 piece of paper that you're only going to use pencil. Okay, well then you're forced to be creative within that specific restricted medium. And it helps you move a lot faster. It helps you really actually get more done when you limit your scope. So that is I think a powerful thing. And especially if you can raise the quality of what you're doing in that constraint, I think that's really cool. Like, in a lot of ways, that's what I'm trying to do with my daily emails and stuff like that. Is that, you know, I try and keep it under 400 words. It goes out 5 days a week. And it's like, how hard hitting of a point and useful of a point can I make within that constraint, right? And it's powerful, because as you do that, you start to really learn the ins and outs of a specific form of work, a specific craft. And it's these unique insights, I think, that are really what allow you to set yourself apart from other people. So, I mean, that's something that we're even continuing to do and evolve in, even in our little once a week podcast format here. Like, you guys probably don't realize it, but there's a lot of conversation that goes on between me and Pete behind the scenes about how do we do this? How do we put this together? How do we make this hour together feel as high value as possible while not allowing it to take over the rest of the business and the work that we do? And you see us, we'll be constantly evolving this as we go, because it's just the way it works. And this is the way it works with everything. It's like bite off a small chunk of something, figure out like what's the thing I want to do here? How can I make it as small and tight and as meaningful as possible? You know, and you want to make it so that you're doing something with a high degree of certainty. So one of the examples I use in the Momentum Method course is that, like, say someone wants to create a YouTube channel for their carpentry business. Say you run a business and, you know, you do like high end carpentry or whatever. And you're like, oh, if we had a YouTube channel, that'd be great for us. Right. Instead of doing some like massive, huge, ambitious project first, do something small. Don't even do a full project. Maybe just focus on one carpentry technique. All right. And just make it a short video, like 5 minutes or less, because that first iteration, there's so much that goes involved with that, that goes into that. It's like, okay, well, you're going to be probably making a thumbnail for your first time. You're going to have to title your first video. You're going to have to figure out how to even record and upload and work your camera and all that kind of stuff. There's so much like, there's so much more work that goes into anything, like doing anything of value, than it seems on the surface, that like you want to make sure that you are keeping these little loops of shipping small, tight, contained, so that you can keep mastering the steps and the craft as you go. And once you reach the limits of that constraint, then yeah, maybe you expand, maybe you move into something bigger, you move to the next ambitious thing. But you don't do it from the beginning, because if you do it from the beginning, you're going to get overwhelmed very quickly. You're going to get, you're going to run into this feeling of being completely daunted of like, oh my God, this is too much. It's going to be this massive stress. And even if you get it out, it's like, there are so many things that are wrong with it that you don't even know where to begin to make it better. But if you keep it small and tight, the places for improvement are far less and more obvious, so that you can do another one. And once you master one, you know, limited frame, then you can expand, you can continue to move beyond it in that way. It's kind of like just turning progress into a video game. Master one level before you try and take on the whole game, right? It's like instead of trying to speed run through to the final boss on the first try, just master the beginning area. And if you can adopt this mentality, it's going to unlock speed in your life like you wouldn't believe. It's the key to doing this, though, is really just a sense of humility. It's the willingness to accept that you don't know what the heck you're doing, and that's okay. Yeah. It's okay. Like, if you're not okay with it, then you can't do this. Really, you're going to crush yourself under your own criticism before you even get launched. And this is what happens to most guys. They get in over their head because they like look at the creators or the people out there doing stuff that they want to do. They dip their toe in that water and they're like, holy shit, there's way more to this than I thought. And they get scared and then they back out and they don't do anything. So just make it easier on yourself first. Just make it way easier. Make it so easy that you know you can do it and you know you can just ship something crappy. So many amazing things. I would say almost all amazing things start with an ultra shitty first draft. All right. And the more quickly you can churn out that shitty first draft, the more quickly you can churn out the slightly less shitty second draft, which leads to, you know, less and less crappy until you have something that's actually genuinely good. And if you keep going, you can have something that's like genuinely like incredible. You just have to be, in this, this incredibly vulnerable position of being willing to enter into the state of becoming, but not yet being. Mm. That's the thing that screws everybody over, is that they are unwilling to be in the state of becoming. It's like, if I can't jump to the state of being who I want to be, then I'm not going to do it. And that's so that like people, they just either try to do everything all at once, overload themselves, burn themselves out, and, you know, fail that way. Or they say, oh, well, I can't do it all at once, so I'm just not going to do it at all. And then they just drown themselves in escapism to distract themselves from the fact that they are not making progress. And so it's like the only path forward is to recognize, all right, I'm a beginner. I don't know what the hell I'm doing, but I'm learning how to get better. That's it. You can embrace that mentality. You can do anything, I think.
There's a lot of people who are 100% on board with you. I would say the majority of people. Even this week I was going through a book summary of Rick Rubin's The Creative Act. And he says, you know,
I have that book. It's a great book.
Okay, well, you can speak to this then more than me, because I haven't actually read the thing. But he, from my understanding, he says, in the beginning stages, yeah, you go crazy and you try to, you're just experimenting. But there reaches a point where, you know, you have to have a time limit on it in order to finish the thing. You know, because he originally thought that this creative, exploratory, you know, section of, okay, making this song applied to the whole thing. He realized, no, you have to transition at some point and put a deadline on it, or you'll ruin it. You'll overbake it. And so a lot of people agree with you. There's a YouTuber.
Well, let me speak to that first, yeah. Because there's one thing about that book that I thought was really brilliant. And what he did was he talked about, or maybe I think it was in the book, either that or it was an interview I heard of him. And for those of you who don't know, Rick Rubin's like a very famous music producer. He's produced some of like the most popular albums of all time. But one of the ways that he looks at creativity is that what you're doing is really making a journal entry. It's like whatever you're producing is just a journal entry of your creative process, of where you're at that time. And when you can look at it like that, is that you're just creating these journal entries each time you engage in the act of shipping something, it frees you up from having to like make anything be like your opus, right? Like that's the biggest trap is thinking that like the thing you produce needs to represent the sum total of your being. That's like, you know, a huge trap, because people think like, well, I have to fully express myself. It's like, well, yeah, but you just need to fully express where you're at right now. And you need to accept that that level of expression is not the totality of your being. Okay. I think it's rare that any artist is able to create a true masterwork. Like that's something that literally takes the dedication of your entire life. And even then, you know, even if you look at these like masterworks, like the Pieta or, you know, the Mona Lisa or whatever the heck it is, those things are still just a snapshot of that creator at that time. And yeah, that creator might have decades of practice and experience under their belt, but I still don't think that the artist in question would usually say that this is the sum total of who they are as an artist. So you have to settle for accepting that. You know, for me, I guess like the way that I deal with that is recognizing, all right, no one thing is going to capture the totality of my creative intent. But if I make enough journal entries, then the end body of work that I produce by the time I die should hopefully get relatively close to what I've got, you know? And so if I make enough quality journal entries, then someone who really wants to see what I have to offer, they're going to be able to get the gist of it. But if you just try and put it all onto one thing, you're fighting a losing battle.
So here's the counter argument to all this, right? Seems like everybody agrees, you know, Stephen Pressfield has written a lot about this, where, you know, you have to turn pro and you have to sit down and you have to get this done and you have to set timelines and da 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 da. Okay, but here's the counter argument. I haven't actually read any of this guy's stuff. From the sounds of it, I wouldn't like it very much. But this guy, Charles Bukowski, has this one poem called So You Want to Be a Writer. And I'll just read you a little snippet from the end there and here to give you an idea. So he says, don't be like so many writers. Don't be like so many thousands of people who call themselves writers. Don't be dull and boring and pretentious. Don't be consumed with self-love. The libraries of the world have yawned themselves to sleep over your kind. Don't add to that. Don't do it. Unless it comes out of your soul like a rocket. Unless being still would drive you to madness or suicide or murder, don't do it. Unless the sun inside you is burning your gut, don't do it. When it is truly time, and if you have been chosen, it will do it by itself, and it will keep on doing it until you die or it dies in you. There's no other way, and there never was. So I don't know about you, Mark, but I've sat down sometimes and something will just like, boom, it's there, it's done.
Yep.
There's no better feeling than that. It's almost, it's so good, sure. You know? So
yeah,
why not wait for those moments and just not do anything at all until those moments come?
Right. Well, so the way that I see it is that, yeah, sometimes the muse will take you and it'll just pop all out, like completely fully formed in one go. But really, what you want to be doing if you're trying to, you know, make a habit of creative work is building the skill of tracking resonance. Okay. So like tracking your unique creative vibe. So on one hand, yes, you don't want to be just churning out stuff that doesn't resonate with you. And I think that is what people end up doing. They think, okay, I just got to put out these like reps. Who cares if I like it or not? I don't think that's the right way to do it. You're not going to get better that way. At least not much better, because there's plenty of people who put a lot of stuff out and it's just not getting better. It's just garbage each time. And the reason for that is because they are not undergoing the process of self-discovery and evolution. And what that really entails is being able to find and track what brings you energy. What brings you energy? That's how you find your creative path in this world. That's how you find your style. You find your vibe. Okay. I actually was tweeting about this the other day, where it's like there's certain people who have just a completely undeniable, unique vibe to what they do. You know, like you look at like Wes Anderson movies. Like he's got, you see any shot out of a Wes Anderson movie and you're like, oh, that's Wes Anderson. Okay. You hear any snippet of a speech from Trump and you're like, oh, that's obviously Trump. Right. It's like you hear any vocal segment from a Michael Jackson song. It's like, oh, that's Michael Jackson. Mm-hmm. Okay. It's like, in order to create something that like is that unique, that it has like the calling card of you baked into like every cell of its being, requires you to know what turns you on. That's really what it is. And so what I think the answer is, it's kind of a hybrid between what Bukowski was saying and what Stephen Pressfield says. It's like, yes, you're a professional. You show up every day and you endeavor to ship. But as you ship, as you're in this process of creating, what you're really building the repetition of is connecting to that internal muse, building that connection to what turns you on and what turns you off, what gives you energy and what steals energy from you. Because sometimes I'll write something and I'll like feel at the end of it, it just like, I just feel like this clunk. It's like this dud. It's like, ugh, I don't like that. That's not who I want. Or maybe I thought it was something that I liked because I saw someone else doing it and I kind of like copied the style or something like that, but it came out and something about it didn't feel right. That's valid. Like that's important. And I try and hold on to that. And I try and figure, all right, what do I like and what don't I like here? And I try and rearrange it if I can to get something that I do. And, you know, you're not going to always nail this first time, but if there's no awareness of that, if there's no awareness of what resonates with you, then what you might have gotten the thing done, but you're not any closer to finding like your path. You're not any closer to finding that thread through existence that really sets you on fire. And so that's what, like, I think Bukowski is talking about here, is like, you have to be willing to go into those places where the inspiration flows through you like an unstoppable force. And this is a skill set. It's something about knowing your own psychic terrain and the way in which you interface with the world so that you can find those spots and those ways in which you can create this connection point between, you know, what I believe to be the God, with God inside of you, the Holy Spirit inside of you trying to come out. And so, you know, true creative work, in my opinion, is a spiritual act. It's something where you are interfacing with God and trying to figure out like what kind of mark is God trying to leave in the world through me. And it's always going to be the things that are, it's irresistibly compelling.
So with all the writing you do, is there any patterns that come up that you've identified as, this is something that brings me a lot of energy, this feels really good? Or is it a new adventure every time you sit down?
For me, it's like, there's a few different things. like one is just speaking to my own problems, you know, speaking to things that like I've discovered that I think are important. Like one of the best ways for me to learn something is to create content out of a thought, out of a point. So sometimes I'll just start with like, here's a pain I'm feeling today. And then I'll just kind of think about, you know, like, well, what's the answer to this? What's the perspective that allows me to overcome this pain? And overcoming pain is compelling to me. I like that. It's like, oh, I can solve my own problem by like organizing my thoughts. Well, then hell yeah.
Yeah.
But then other times it's kind of like some of my best stuff is stuff that has me like maniacally chuckling at the end of it. It's just being like just like cackling because I was just like, I like what I'm doing is like, it feels mischievous. It feels like adventurous. It feels daring. It feels a little bit dangerous. And I think that like really good art does that. And not even just, don't even restrict the art. Like what I was just talking to you about before on this call about, you know, the potential branding ideas.
Yeah.
Like that, that's one of those things that gets me like chuckling, like, oh, that'd be sick. And so that's the way I kind of look at it. It's like, you got to be willing to go into your own weird quirkiness and figure out what is just appealing to you, what sounds fun to you. And then, yes, of course, you have to maybe, depending on what you're doing, you have to figure out how to connect that to an audience. You know, if it's, if you have like a, like for me, you know, we serve clients. So it has to connect to someone out in the world who's willing to pay for something. So there is that aspect of it. But for other people, you know, it might be enough just simply to learn how to produce something you like. But I think for most of us, we do want to have that connection. So it's like this internal conversation about like, all right, I can create art that's completely selfish. And sometimes that works out for people. Sometimes that works out incredibly well for people. But for others, you know, there has to be like, okay, not just what sounds incredibly exciting for me alone, what also sounds exciting to share? What actually provides that altruistic juice of like, oh, this could actually serve someone. Mm-hmm. This could actually scratch this itch in another person as well.
Is there anyone who comes to mind as a great example who's been able to do that successfully out of these guys, you know, Wes Anderson and Michael Jackson and all these? Do you have a favorite example of somebody who's really taken this all the way?
Well, I mean, sure, there's plenty of people. I mean, you can argue that most of the really big names today, they've done this to some degree. Like Joe Rogan.
That's true.
I mean, like, he's got his interests. He simply is, in a lot of cases, like, he's built a massive, massive audience simply following his own personal curiosity. Now, I would argue there's definitely some awareness of the audience and stuff that goes into his thing, but that's definitely a case. In terms of comedy, Matt and Shane's secret podcast, like those guys, it's like hanging out with like my high school buddies.
Yeah.
Like that's, we're like, well, I'll listen. I don't know if you've ever listened to them, but like they are like the essence of what it's like to hang out and just shoot the shit with my friends. So it's like, there's something so deeply unique that if you are in that, you know, that segment of the zeitgeist, it just hits home super hard. And now they are far and away the biggest Patreon podcast.
I didn't know that.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. Another one is Tim Robinson. If you've ever seen I Think You Should Leave, it's sketch comedy, but it's very different. And it's very, it's got a completely unique style that you've not seen anywhere else, but it captures some truth about like, some of the most awkward moments in life and the most awkward people you meet that you've never really seen delivered in other ways before. It's definitely not going to be everyone's cup of tea, but there's, you know, I've like almost stopped breathing laughing so hard at some of his sketches. So yeah, I mean, there's a lot of people out there doing this, and these are the people that like I love. And even if I don't actually even like what they're doing, I'm not a huge Michael Jackson fan, but I'm fascinated by how unique he was able to be.
Right.
You know, and that's the thing is like, if you are undeniably a unique character who's being authentic, not just someone who's putting on a crazy affect for the sake of being sensational. I hate that shit. Like there's so many people out there like that who are like, they put on this clearly fake persona for attention and clicks and stuff like that. And guess what? That works for stupid people. Like that's why like, you know, and there's plenty of people who are doing that. But like when you can find those people who are being genuine in a, I would say, vulnerable way, you know, vulnerability sounds kind of like gay, but really what I'm talking about with being vulnerable is that they're willing to be so authentic and perceived as weird that, yeah, there will be people who think they're weird, but then they're other people who just vibe with it so intensely that you then earn like diehard fans.
It's reminding me of a story about Tony Robbins who, this homeless guy asked him for change. This is kind of unrelated, but I think it's funny. This homeless guy asked Tony Robbins for change and he pulls out some change and he pulls out $300 and he says to the homeless man, life's going to give you what you ask for, you know, and you know, he goes on to say, you know, you ask and it'll be given to you, blah, 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 blah. And, this homeless guy is like looking at the $300. Then he looks at Tony and then he looks at the change. Then he looks at the $300. He looks at Tony, looks at the change. He looks at Tony and he says, you're weird. And then he grabs the change and runs. Why didn't he grab cash though? That's the real power of that story, man. He wasn't even worth the cash in his own self-esteem. But, you know, speaking of guys who have something that is really unique, there's this guy I find really fascinating. His name is Jack Stratton. And he's got a minimalistic funk band. And they eBay auction crazy stuff. One of these albums that he put out, he eBay auctioned a spot on the album. So you could buy this eBay auction and just put your own song in there or put whatever you wanted into this, their album that they would release on Spotify and everything. And then they did it again. And they just did a wedding at some festival because they put up an eBay auction for whatever fan won was going to get married on stage. They had the drummer go through one of these kind of BS certificate programs where you can become a minister, a licensed minister or something from the Universal Church of whatever. Right. And he married them on stage. I'm like, it's such a bizarre combination of things to his whole aesthetic, but I'm right with you. There's so many guys like that who have this specific thing and it's so intriguing. I absolutely love it. It's so much fun.
Well, and so what that's doing there is like, yes, they're doing like their own unique take on it, but what's like from a marketing business standpoint that they're doing that's so valuable is that they're creating the opportunity for extraordinary intimacy, yes. Right? For that individual to have a connection with them that is fundamentally unique. And as things become more, you know, mass produced, more AI generated, the true premium content, the true premium level of things will really be all about how much intimacy you get in the process. You know, it's like, are you going to be talking to a real person who's going to be walking you through things? Or are you going to be talking to like an AI voice generated thing that takes you through a series of, you know, automated prompts, right? Like the learning how to create that is really, truly viable for people today. Like there are bands out there that make a solid living because they've mastered this. You know, they might have a relatively small fan base, you know, not really doing much in terms of like ticket sales and concerts and stuff like that, but they've done such a good job of doing weird shit like what you described and selling, you know, limited edition vinyl and, you know, special, you know, access to the band and all of that kind of thing, that they can create, you know, very things that people are willing to pay quite a lot of money for. Even if they do only have a small audience. And that's why I think like learning about this stuff and talking about this stuff is really important for ambitious guys today, because the internet has allowed you to access the whole world. And so the more niche you are, the more you can very strongly connect with a small number of people. Mm. And you know, there's a whole book, what was it called, about like 1,000 true fans, yes, where it's like you can create a very thriving business with just 1,000 true fans. And it's true. You just got to learn how to properly monetize and, you know, bring these people what they want the most. And so, you know, it's never been more possible to do this for someone who's willing to really delve into their own passions.
I think Scott Olford had a has a testimonial of one. Scott Olford is a business consultant guy. Is that an accurate way to put him?
Yeah. Yeah, he's like a expert at scaling businesses.
Yeah, he has a case study of one of his clients had 800 followers on Facebook, I think. And she did tens of thousands of dollars a month. It's crazy.
Yeah.
It doesn't take a lot of people. And, you know, there's a lot of artists today who are blowing up on TikTok and stuff. They got millions of views and their streams are insane. They have incredible streams. And they can't sell a single ticket to their hometown show.
Right.
And then you have other people who don't have any really impressive numbers on any platform, including Spotify. And they sell out 3,000 cap rooms because they go deep, not wide. So there's definitely a value to do that. And everybody wants to be, you know, the star. Everybody wants to be known by everybody. But if you start small and you really build value for one person, that's just going to ripple outward. Because guess what? They're going to, those people who got married on that concert stage, I guarantee you every single person they know knows about that. Not only that, the thousands of people in attendance think that band is super cool because they do something unique on stage. The media, the press, you never know who's going to cover something like that. So it's like, why not go deep with people and really help them out in a tremendously valuable way. But
yeah, well, I just want to say one last thing about that is that, you know, I've been doing this online thing for like 10 years now.
Yeah.
And really it's like I think the secret formula is one half of it is doing something that really truly excites you or at least interests you. Okay. Like you got to have authentic alignment with it on some level. But then it's about being able to really narrow your focus down to a specific individual that you want to create a meaningful experience for. There has to be like a fundamental generosity of spirit where you're like, all right, for this kind of person who's just like this, they are going to absolutely love this. Mm. And creating with that charity mindset, there, that desire to really altruistically, positively impact that person's life. And the reason I point that out is because it's so easy to get lost in the, oh, well, what kind of numbers is this going to do? You know, it's like how many followers could I get with this? And there's a lot of people who have, you know, they know how to play that mass appeal game. They have huge followings on social media, but they don't really make shit. You know, honestly, they don't really make that much money because the connection is wide but shallow. So, yeah. Hmm. And in order, if you want to go deep with people, that's where the money's at. And if you want to really do that, you got to go deep with yourself in your own creative process, how we were talking about in the beginning.
And going back to the beginning and kind of relating to this, too, one of the things that I think could be part of your calling card and doesn't have to be, I'm not locking you up to this, but one thing that you're very good at is asking questions, and that's something you've put the reps in on a lot. I mean, being a coach for 10 years. So I wanted to ask you, what out of all those questions that you've asked guys, which one do you think has been the most effective for helping them out and going deep and intimate with their problems?
Yeah. I mean, it's so obvious. It's so straightforward. But really it's the question of what do you want to have happen? You know, that's literally like I've been a professional question asker for 10 years. Like that's what you do as coaching primarily, is asking questions. And so often people lose sight of that, of like, well, what do you want to have happen here? Right. They'll come to me and they'll be all torn up in knots. They got this problem going on. They got that problem going on. When they try and fix it, this internal block comes up and they got this limiting belief and, you know, their inner critic saying all of this. And at the end of it, I'm just like, well, okay, I hear you on this, this, and this. Well, what do you want to have happen? And then there's like this dumbfounded silence, like they never thought about it. And this is the thing, right? Like it's so easy to get caught up in what is happening. And particularly, it's easy to fall into a victim state around it, of being like, oh, this sucks, or oh, this is hard, or I don't know what to do. All of those thoughts are, you know, valid, and you're going to have to sort through them and whatnot. But at the end of the day, if you don't come back and ask yourself the question of, okay, well, what do I want to have happen here? Given all that, what do I want to have happen? If you don't come back to that, then you can never form a useful intention. And so really, the more frequently and reflexively you can get with that question with yourself, the more intentionally and clearly and effectively you are going to live.
Here's a question for you. If you don't know what you want, how do you figure that out?
That's a good question. Well, you can usually start with, what do you not want to have happen? So that's, if people don't know what they do want to have happen, it's usually pretty clear about what they don't want to have happen. It's like, list, okay, well, what are all the things that you could do to make stuff worse here? You know, what would move us in the opposite direction? Okay. And so we can pretty quickly lay out a bunch of things like, okay, well, don't do that. Don't do that. Don't do that. Don't do that. And it's like, okay, well, all right, that'll stop a lot of the bleeding. Would you agree? And they're like, yeah, yeah, that would. And it's like, okay, so given all of that, what do you think might start moving things in the positive direction? You know, what are just some options? And then you just got to list options, right? Like, discernment, what I found is, like, it's a very simple but deep art. Discernment of the proper path forward is as simple as list a bunch of options of even remotely viable paths. Just literally write them down. Okay. I'll do this in coaching calls with people. I'll just be like, all right, give me option one. I'll write it down. Give me another option. I'll write it down. And then after we have a list, I'll be like, okay, so of these options, which one kind of resonates with you, or which ones have the most resonance? Okay. And if they're like, I don't know, it's like, well, which ones definitely don't resonate? I'm like, okay, that one, that one, that one. Okay, we'll pare it down. And it's like, so these ones that are left, which of these, like, what do you like potentially about these? Even if it's only in a little bit, what do you potentially like about these options? And you just start diving into it, start digging into where the resonance exists. And you apply that. You can apply this to literally anything in life, you know, big or small. It's just list options and start tracking the resonance. This is one of the big things I teach in the Momentum Method, because, like, if you want to move rapidly through things in life, you need to be able to make decisions quickly. And doing this is a act of both intellect and instinct. So intellect, that's the part that runs the simulation and produces all these list options. Okay, and so we gotta have a functioning intellect. We gotta have an imagination that can run scenarios and create options. And everybody can do this, all right, as long as they ask simple and basic enough questions. But then the way that we choose, we don't choose with our intellect, because ultimately, like, there are a million things we all can come up with of, like, what we should be doing. That's all intellect. It's like, well, I should be doing this. I should have this habit. I should stop doing this, and yada, yada, yada. We don't do any of that. Why? Because it's all up here. Ultimately, what moves us is what's down here, our instinct, our emotion. And so what we're looking for is, when we create this list of intellectual options, is like, where is the emotional juice? Where is the thing that has some power behind it that we can use to actually start putting stuff in motion? So it's kind of like, you think about your intellect as like the first mate of the ship. You know, he's laying out all the potential courses you could take your life. But the captain is your instinct. He's the one who analyzes everything and moves from his gut. He says, that's the direction we're going to go. And sometimes it goes in the face of pure logic. But, you know, as you begin to understand this, you realize that that's not actually in the face of logic. It's just working with true reality. And the reality is, we're not robots. You know, we're not. We are meaty, imperfect humans with flesh and weirdly formed limbic systems and preferences and stuff like that. And so it's like, it often makes a lot more sense to go with a less than optimal path that you have a lot of energy behind. Now, you don't want to ever pick a path that, like, we outright rationally think is bad. Okay. Like, there should be at least some kind of rational alignment with it, Okay, it should be, it should theoretically still get you toward where you want to go. But it's okay if it's a detour. It's okay if it's the scenic route. All right? And if it's like the scenic route that you travel is infinitely better than the ultra optimized route that you will never go down.
Yeah. That makes sense. You know, here's the problem though. I find it difficult to actually get myself to begin that process, and I think a lot of other people mm-hmm. do, where it's like, okay, I don't know what to do, but figuring out and doing that process that you spoke of, doing that yeah. is painful, because sometimes, yes. and speaking of myself, I can't speak for other people, when I go down and I say, okay, what do I want, what's resonating, what's not, sometimes I get a conflicting answer, I get some double-mindedness going on inside here, mm-hmm. and I got corn and I got weeds growing in the same dirt patch, and I got to get my hands dirty and I got to do some gardening, right? So right. is that a conditioning problem? Is that, you know, is that a thing where you just got to tough it up and say, well, I'm going to do it anyway? Or is there any mentality that you can kind of run through to make that process easier?
Sure. I think there's a couple of pieces to that, because that's a really good question, because it is uncomfortable, particularly when you're still learning. Heck, it's always uncomfortable, because basically when you have conflicting answers in your head,
yeah,
that is literally cognitive dissonance.
Yeah.
And cognitive dissonance is functionally and uncomfortable to bear. All right. It's like it's a painful state to be in. So one of the things you can do to help yourself out like right away is, before you go into like trying to figure something out, is like let yourself vent first. Like just have an emotional vent where you say all the irrational emotional shit and get that out of the way. And ideally, you kind of just respond to it from an attitude of, you know, positive rationality and encouragement, where like you weave in some gratitude, some perspective, all that kind of stuff. And usually that clears out a bunch of the gunk. But then, you know, you still have like parts where it's going to be unclear about how you should move forward. There's still going to be cognitive dissonance. And in some ways, like this is a conditioning thing. It's like you have to train your brain to be able to hold conflicting ideas. Like, who was it? I forget. This might be attributed to Einstein, but like something, the quote, something along the lines of like the sign of a first-rate intelligence is being able to hold two contradicting ideas in your head at the same time. So like part of this is like, you know, you need to condition your muscles to be able to lift heavy weights. You need to condition your mind to be able to hold opposing ideas. So part of this is one of these things where it'll get better the more you do it. But I think just strategically how you can overall make this far more relaxed and comfortable, like is my personal philosophy is I don't ever expect myself to do something that I don't legitimately want to do. Like I'm never going to force myself to walk a path that I don't resonate with. And so it's like I go into this process of discernment knowing that I'm not just going to force some bullshit answer that I don't like. Because I think that's really the big fear, is that if we go into this process sincerely of truly trying to discern the right path, we're afraid that we're going to come up with an answer that we don't like. And so that's what we're most afraid of, where it's just like we're trapped in this world where the only path forward is something we absolutely hate. And as long as you go into it with the idea of like, listen, I'm never going to force you to do something you really hate, ever. Like, so those options are not actually options. And that then creates the space to truly create your own custom path, the thing that truly aligns and resonates with you. And so much of the work, honestly, is just learning how to take that pressure off yourself and being willing to trust that there is a path forward that feels good. And, you know, it's not always going to feel entirely good. All right, there is a difference between surface level emotions and deep emotions. Sometimes you're going to have a path that feels comfortable on the surface, but as you dig into it, it makes you feel anxious on like down in your core. So this would be like an example of like, all right, what am I going to do with the rest of my day? You know, I would love to just, like, you know, surf the internet and take it super easy today. And if you think about that, maybe on the surface, that's like, oh, that sounds nice. There's all this Netflix I wanted to watch or something. But if deep in your core, it creates an anxiety, that's probably not the way you want to go. On the flip side, there's also going to be times where a path forward, it fills you with anxiety. It's like, holy shit, this is going to be hard. I don't know how to do this. It's definitely going to push me outside my comfort zone. But the thought of surrendering and committing to that path brings an interior peace. Okay. Ultimately, what you want to be doing is focusing more on that interior path, because you want that interior peace, that interior relief of knowing that you are doing what is, like, most authentic. But there has to be some compassion in the process. You have to be willing to make sure that it's not so frightening that you're going to, like, completely abandon the path and drown yourself in, you know, overwhelm. All right. So it's about really walking the tension between these, but really focusing on trying to create as much internal peace as possible, while managing, you know, whatever the surface level comfort is. You know, realizing that, like, it's actually just not helpful to completely put yourself into a state of torture, especially when you can't sustain it, because that's just then an exercise in failure.
I'll tell you another thing that I think contributes to this problem as well, and that is, I think fear of coming up with an answer you don't like is a huge one. I also think pride is one. For me especially, it's like, I shouldn't be feeling this right now. So I don't want to feel it. So go away.
Right. Yeah. That's what I call a meta emotion. It's an emotion about an emotion. And what I found is that in coaching guys, you can't actually solve core issues as long as meta emotions exist. So for example, you know, I've helped a lot of guys quit porn. And if they feel like they shouldn't be attracted to porn, they feel like, oh, I shouldn't even want this thing, and they're like mad at themselves about it, well, I'm never going to be able to help them really quit. They have to move to a state of acceptance of, okay, this is where my emotions are at. Because a meta emotion is basically just being at war with reality. It's like getting mad that there's only 24 hours in a day. Sorry, it's just the way the universe works, okay? It's completely a waste of time and energy to be mad at the fact that there's only 24 hours in the day. That's just the way it works. And so it's the same way. It's like, if you actually feel a certain way, being mad about that, you know, what are you going to do? You're just shouting at reality, and reality always wins. So there has to be the humility of accepting the truth of the circumstance. And to do that, you know, obviously the best thing you could do is embrace your own dignity. You got to realize that even though you are deficient in this, maybe you do, this is a sign that there is some aspect of your moral or psychological development is lacking. Okay. You've got a feeling that is irrational, immature, disordered, whatever. Doesn't make you any worse. Just makes you human. And that's okay. And as long as you're willing to accept that, i.e. love yourself, well, then you can start getting to the work of actually solving whatever that core issue is.
I liken it to, if you're laying in bed and you got to wake up early the next day, and you're laying there and you're going, man, I really need to get to sleep right now, or else I'm going to be tired all day tomorrow. So you tell yourself you have to go to sleep, which is like the number one way to guarantee you will not sleep at all that night. You know, right. What I mean? Yeah.
It's like, there's so many things that just, like, you have to let them be natural. Right. The way you sleep is you just stop thinking about sleep. You just let it go. Right. And it's the same thing with a lot of this stuff. It's like, all right, it is what it is. I'm behind in this thing. I'm deficient in that thing. All right. What do I want to have happen? And then you just kind of create the intention and let it go. You know, do whatever is necessary. And in the case of going to sleep, what's necessary is doing nothing. Yeah. Let your mind wander and eventually you'll pass out.
Yeah. And it's that spiritual pride or that moral pride, I think, moral status that you'd point out. It's when you let go of all other forms of status and you become John the Baptist and you're eating honey and bugs and you're dressed in camel, that's the one that'll get you.
Yeah. Yeah, you gotta let go. Be where you're at. Anything else is a lie. You know, if you're too proud to acknowledge where you are at, then you are too proud to advance. And in my book that I wrote, or little guide that I wrote years ago called Anabolic Optimism, I have all these axioms for like mindset stuff. And one of them is progress is as smooth as you are humble. So it's like, if you want to evolve the most rapidly, then really what that requires is for you to be humble enough to be brutally honest with yourself at any given moment. And as long as you could do that, well, then you can get right down to the business of solving whatever your current issue is. But if you're not humble, you know, you take offense at where you are at, you judge yourself where you're at, you get mad at yourself over where you're at, all you've done is created another problem that has to be overcome before you can get to the root one.
Yeah. Well, this was a great conversation. I don't want to keep you too long. I know you got busy stuff to take care of, but is there anything you want to tell the guys listening right now?
Big thing is, you know, we talked a lot about the momentum method here. So make sure you check out the guide, you know, down below. You can click the link. You can see if it's something that you would like. I think for any guy who's ambitious, who's looking to make unlock high performance at high speed, the momentum method is essential. So go ahead and check that out. And otherwise, you know, make sure you're getting the newsletter, which I guess you would get if you signed up there. Also put another, I guess, link to the newsletter if you want to get my daily emails. Because I think they're fun. I think they're cool. And other than that, I think that's pretty much it. Thanks for listening, my friends. Look forward to hearing your feedback on the episode. And we'll see you all in the next one. Ooh, yeah.